Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here, we discuss some real news. Moscow has suffered the worst terrorist attack in 20 years. Many are blaming Ukraine and its Western patrons. Also, an American-sponsored UN Security Council resolution on Gaza failed to pass. This marks the utter failure of American policy that is abetting genocide. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Alexander Eitan in St. Petersburg. He is a senior lecturer at St. Petersburg State Institute of Technology. And here in Moscow, we have Dmitry Babich. He's an analyst at Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules. In effect, that means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Dima here in Moscow. It's been 2 days now since this horrific terrorist attack on Moscow. What are your thoughts? What have you been thinking over the last 2 days? Because, of course, there's a lot of finger pointing. Obviously, many people here, as you well know, are blaming somehow the Ukrainians for what happened here. There's a lot of unanswered questions. 133 people and counting are dead, more than 150 injured. A lot of questions. Your thoughts, my friend?
Well, right now, as we are talking, the death toll raised to 154 people, and it will be, unfortunately, most likely, the number will even be higher. So it's a huge misfortune, really terrible terrorist act. And I think we can excuse some people for being too emotional and suggesting simple solutions. We all remember how in the United States after 9/11, people were saying all kinds of things. And then it was, of course, easy to blame them, you know, later on, years after, what the hell were you saying? Is this, we're at this stage right now. But, okay, let's be honest. Let's just stick to the facts. The terrorists were trying to flee to Ukraine. The United States and the West in general say they are from some ISIS group, ISIS Khorasan, that few people have known before, that they were acting on their own. Well, here are the facts that just don't jive with that. You know, first, they were not suicide killers.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
They fled, right? That doesn't look like ISIS. Then also, why did they flee to Ukraine? Why didn't they flee to some Muslim region of Russia or to Central Asia or to the Caucasus, while they were trying to flee to Ukraine. And they were arrested not far from the Ukrainian border in the Bryansk region, which borders on Ukraine. Then also, you can ask, well, you know, why are you suspecting Ukraine? Why are you suspecting the United States? Well, the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, was the only one who did not express any kind of condolences for Russians. He just blamed it as usual on President Putin. He insulted President Putin in his short speech, calling him all sorts of names. That speech was not even political. It sounded like, you know, a hooligan.
Well, to be fair, I'm no fan of the Ukrainian president. I mean, what else would you expect from him, you know, an emotional reaction like that? Let me go to Alexander here. Alexander, Dima's doing a very good job here of giving the chronology here. Where do you want to pick it up and where do you want to add?
Well, I would say that blaming ISIS is not necessarily better than blaming Ukraine because it's the open secret that ISIS has connections to the CIA. ISIS has connections to Mossad. So if we're saying that it was ISIS, well, we kind of are pointing fingers in the same direction anyway. And we can't forget how in 2017, when ISIS struck Israeli positions, they apologized to Israel. What kind of an Islamic terror organization is this that apologizes to Israel? It's very odd. And there's been reports that, ISIS agents were arrested and they turned out to be Israeli. So this is not some kind of homegrown terrorist organization. So to say that it's ISIS is just a very convenient way to pretend.
There's no doubt that they were terrorists. I mean, they were captured, all four of them, and in total, there's 11 people have been detained. But Alexander, I mean, from the initial interviews, and maybe they were under duress, we have to find out more. But I mean, there was a financial motive, obviously. I mean, they're saying how much money they were paid to do this. we have to find out how they got into the country. One of them said he had recently been in Turkey. So, I mean, there's a lot of very strange things here. And Alexander, I'll throw in here, the initial American response is that Ukraine didn't do it. That's rather strange in my mind, okay? Coming out with a negative instead of something affirmative. Alexander, continue.
Well, what I found interesting with the interrogations of these detained individuals is that they honestly just seemed very unintelligent. Whether they were speaking Russian or a native language, they just seemed dumb to me. And this really reminds me of something that we in America are very used to at this point, which this comes straight out of the FBI playbook. So what the FBI likes to do is they somehow, through some chat room, through the internet, connect with some unintelligent person and start feeding them ideas about, oh, maybe you should go commit some kind of violence. And they link them up with somebody who gives them some weapons or trains them in how to make some kind of bomb. And then the FBI swoops in and says, ah, we got these terrorists. So to then see the way these guys are acting, it's, you know, it really reminds me of the things that the U.S. government does to its own population. And here we have the same sort of a playbook being used with these terrorists. So it seems to be, you know, same guys perhaps coming up with the same ideas, whether they're trying to attack Americans or Russians.
But Dima, you know, some of the footage I have seen, and I'm sure it's not exhaustive here, but one thing I have to say that really surprised me, even kind of shocked me, that these guys just waltzed right into the forum. I mean, with no resistance whatsoever. That's extraordinary. Dima.
Well, of course, there were problems with security at this Crocus City Hall. But, you know, it's far from Moscow Center.
Yes.
It has been a very trendy place for rich people for many years. So nothing happened there just because it is so far from the poor, dangerous quarters, you know. It's like in any country, you know, you don't expect terrible things to happen somewhere where people are so used to having fun. You know, you just don't connect it. So I understand why the security could be lax, especially after the election was over. You know, Putin won with 87% of the vote. The nation has shown its unity. So people, I think, just kind of relaxed.
But I'm glad you brought that up, Dima. Is that part of the timing of all this? Because, of course, we all, and I don't want to waste time on Western coverage of Russia's presidential election. That'd be a waste of our time here. But it seems that this is kind of trying to spoil the moment of unity that the Russians had after the election. I mean, do you think that's part of the timing? It can't be a coincidence, Dima.
It could be. I mean, it could be. Well, I mean, I'm not going to say something that I haven't seen myself, you know, lest we are accused of conspiracy theories. Just let me tell you a few things about the United States and their attitude to Islamists that I have seen myself, you know, from my journalist experience. You know, I worked as a translator with several Western newspaper and television teams during the war in Chechnya. They were all extremely, I'm not even pro-Chechen, no, pro-Islamist, because in the end of the 90s, you know, after the first phase of the war, the so-called Chechen resistance was dominated by the Islamists. And the Western media was completely in bed with them. You know, it was not like, you know, even 90 to 10%. It was 99% for Mashadov and Basayev, and maybe 1% sympathy for some peaceful Russians, you know, local people. But that was very, very clear to me that in that war, the West, despite differences in ideology, supported the Islamists. The same story in Syria. I mean, Assad's government, whatever you say about it, was secular and is secular. And whom did the United States and the European Union, by the way, whom did they support in the end? The Islamists. If you tell me that ISIS only just somehow sprang up in the end of 2013, you know, when Obama just was too cowardly to bomb the Syrian positions, I can't believe it. You know, organizations like that, they
all we have to do is read Hillary Clinton's emails, and we have a very clear picture of the relationship.
Exactly. So there are so many cases when you don't have to look at the documents, you just have to look at the Western media. Whose side was it on in all of these confrontations? It was on the side of the Islamists several times against secular governments. The same story in Libya, by the way.
Well, we have Alexander, we have a bit of a smoking gun, and it was something that I actually had predicted, not obviously this horrific event, but I mean, as Victoria Nuland goes out the door, I'm paraphrasing here, she has some nasty surprises for the Russians. I mean, you know, take it, you know, at face value, I guess. Alexander.
Well, sure. It's like when Biden let slip that one way or another will stop the Nord Stream pipeline. So, yeah, these folks in the U.S. government aren't, I've said this before, I don't think they're the brightest people. And they're very, very arrogant. They're very arrogant. So they feel that they have total power and can do anything they want. And so they sometimes just say what they're going to do, even though they really shouldn't if they're being more strategic about it. So yeah, I agree with you. There's really not a lot of surprise here. And then, of course, we had the U.S., apparently warning the Russian government about terrorist threats. Well, what are these threats? Where did this information come from? How do you have details, or what details do you have? The Russian side says they were given no specifics. But I don't know, it's just odd behavior, odd in the way that the United States says who did it or who didn't do it. It's just odd rhetoric that matches the rhetoric we get from these leaders.
And it also kind of matches a pattern. I mean, if we again focus our attention on Ukraine, as all of us know and our viewers know, the war is going very badly for the Ukrainian side. NATO is panicking, and we see more and more assaults on civilians inside of Russia by probably targeting by Western troops and technicians and firing into Russia. I mean, this is getting to a point of desperation. So that kind of dovetails into this kind of chronology. If you can't win on the battlefield, then you'll go asymmetrical, as Victoria Nuland suggested while during her last trip to Kiev before we heard that she will be leaving her position. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter LaBelle. Here, we're discussing some real news. All right, gentlemen, I want to change gears here. I want to go back to Alexander. Another fiasco of a diplomatic nature. At the end of last week, we had the United States proposed a resolution to the Security Council. Remarkably, 6 months after the whole world has been calling for a ceasefire, the United States called for a ceasefire. Except for it wasn't a ceasefire, and it ended up being a complete fiasco. I will add to that, while this was going on, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, was on his sixth tour of the Middle East. What he's doing, nobody really particularly knows because there's no results. And if I'm not mistaken, he was leaving, going back to the United States, and he was informed by the media that 2,000 acres of West Bank land territory under occupation by the Israeli government was seized from Palestinians. And he's being told this, I think he wasn't even aware of it. At least his body language tells us that. I mean, it's, and oh, one more thing I'll add before I'll throw back to you, Alexander. The Speaker of the House, Johnson, is inviting Netanyahu to speak to Congress. I mean, all of this together. So what was this resolution all about, except for trying to pull wool over everyone's eyes? Alexander.
Yeah, the influence of the Israeli government in the United States government is massive, and we see that constantly. So Congress, which can't agree on anything, they'll then have a vote on should we pass a resolution on supporting Israel. And that always passes with 99% of the votes. A couple of people maybe will just not vote. What kind of a divided political system, what left-right you know, a system is this when it's 100% support of a foreign state? And when you look at the composition of the United States government, many of these people are Jewish and then go out on TV and talk about how they're very loyal to Israel. They go in front of AIPAC and declare that their purpose is to support Israel. Well, what about the people of the United States? So we have government officials openly declaring their allegiance to the state of Israel and not to the interests of the United States people, to the American people. So many of them are working for the interests of Israel. And that's when you get these kinds of deranged debacles like Jared Kushner's plan for peace in the Middle East, which arguably has led to this situation.
Well, I saw his part of his interview that he was at the Kennedy School of Government. I mean, a very official venue, okay, DEMA. And Jared Kushner was talking about real estate on the Gaza coast. I mean, if it doesn't get more morbid than that, that's morose, DEMA.
Well, unfortunately, Blinken is no Kissinger for a very simple reason. You know, Kissinger maybe made even less trips to the Middle East before clutching the deal, for example, the deal that he clutched. But the problem was that Kissinger was more or less free in his movements and decisions. You know, he could cut the deals. You know, Blinken is tied by this neoliberal, globalist, ultra-liberal ideology. And the narratives which are suggested by the U.S. media, they are very predictable. I mean, like, in the last few weeks, the narrative was like, yes, we support Israel, but somehow Netanyahu is bad. Biden is losing his patience with Netanyahu. Netanyahu is just too cruel, you know. If it hadn't been for Netanyahu, people wouldn't have been killed in such numbers.
I've been following this circus as well. Let me throw it back to Alexander. I mean, yeah, all of this criticism, but, you know, this the way, particularly the United States and the Europeans more and more so, they personalize everything. And once this person goes, everything will be fine. Well, no, that's not fine. We had Chuck Schumer very publicly criticizing Benjamin Netanyahu. But he didn't. What is the result? There's no result. The same thing continues here. This is a macabre theater that's being played out here. And then, Alexander, you have the Biden's peer idea, which, of course, came from the Israelis, to get aid into Gaza. No, the idea is to get Gazans out through this peer to have them dispelled. I mean, most people in American media won't even address the most simple, fundamental issues of this chaotic situation. Alexander.
Yeah, well, this is the problem of democracy in the West. So the media pretends that it matters who is the president, and they pretend that, oh, if we change the wallpaper, change the president in an election, which may or may not be rigged, then everything will be different. But every time we have an election, new president, same policies. And I think they're also pretty relaxed on what the rhetoric can be in some cases. So it's okay to criticize Netanyahu because there will be no action. It's always just words. They feel pressure from the international community. They maybe even feel pressure from some of the protests that have been happening in the United States on campuses and in some cities against the slaughter in Gaza. So there is some pushback. There's some pressure. So they relieve the pressure with some of this rhetoric, but everyone knows that there will not be any action. The system is designed to prevent action.
I guess it's so blatantly obvious that you had the highest elected Jewish official in American history, Chuck Schumer, in the Senate. And he has this, what many would say, kind of blistering critique of Benjamin Netanyahu. And then within two or three news cycles, he says, oh, yes, we should welcome to speak to Congress. I mean, what are we supposed to think? I mean, who's calling the shots here? Dima, I saw you see you laughing. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's not only limited to Israel, that story about good government and bad person in that government. You know, during the Maidan, since it was absolutely impossible to hide that 38 policemen were killed, you know, during this peaceful protest, you know, that actually it was an armed coup. You remember the narrative was like, oh, these are all nice people on that square, but there is a group called Right Sector. They're bad, you know, but they're a minority. Don't pay attention to them. The same story was with that terrorist Chechen government under Maskhadov. You know, Maskhadov was the president and his prime minister was Shamil Basayev, who several times committed heinous terrorist acts, you know, taking thousands of hostages. And the narrative from the Western press was, it's a nice government, it's independent Chechnya. Just, you know, this guy Basayev is somehow bad.
Yeah, they always kind of portrayed him as a Solzhenitsyn with a Kalashnikov or something.
Exactly. Like. No, Robin Hood with a bazooka. That was the same. Unfortunately, it came from a Russian person from our liberal. But anyway, so I'm kind of tired of this narrative. Like, Israel is good, Netanyahu is bad. I mean, I remember I covered Netanyahu summit meetings with Yeltsin. If we talk about changing the wallpaper, somehow Netanyahu stays at the top of Israeli politics for more than 27, 28 years. And they just say he's a rotten apple. We're losing patience with him. You have been losing that patience for almost 30 years. You know, isn't it just a bit too long, you know, to lose your nerve about someone?
Well, I mean, his longevity, Alexander, is because of Zionism. I mean, it has only one direction. You know, what's happening in Gaza is it's destroying all of our humanity, even by being witnesses to it. We are losing our humanity. But there is the powers that be are so powerless because they've been captured by this ideology. For Zionists, what's happening in Gaza is called an opportunity. It is a final solution. And they know that they can get the West to be complicit here. I mean, when I look at Anthony Blinken, I came up with it. I call him the Undertaker because he is the Undertaker of what any kind of Western values the West believes it can give to the world. This is a funeral for Western values. Even that we might, you know, mock them as, you know, PR and, you know, talking points, but I mean, core values are being destroyed right now.
Well, the Zionists in the United States and the Zionists in Israel, they all perfectly understand the game they're playing. So they may pretend to disagree on certain issues, but they all agree on the one important thing of supporting Israel no matter what it does, no matter what horrors it carries out against the Palestinians. And you see this playing out in the American media in very interesting ways. For example, Ben Shapiro, who is rabid in his support of Israel and says really unhinged things about how they should kill people. He's in a feud with Candace Owens because she's criticizing this Zionism and she's criticizing this monolithic policy of supporting Israel and never admitting to the fact that this is wrong. So one problem we have, this really big problem in the United States, is that organizations like AIPAC and the Anti-Defamation League, they go around bullying people, organizations, just trying to instill a sense of terror in organizations and people. So they will not speak out, will not question anything Israel does, will not question the Zionists and the American government, at risk of having their livelihoods destroyed, at risk of being deplatformed. There's so many people who have lost access to banking, who have had all of their social media turned off, who many people are living outside of the United States because it's impossible for them to make a living, impossible for them to live in the U.S., or they'll just be sued into oblivion. That's another extra legal way of handling things. So the government may not officially take away your freedom of speech, but we'll just sue you into oblivion so you are financially unable to do anything. We'll use the private companies that the government orders to silence you, but it's not the government. So for some reason, the First Amendment has now been redefined. It doesn't apply to everything. It only applies to the government. So the government will use tools like Facebook, Twitter, and so on to silence people that way.
Well, one of the other casualties is that conservatives spoke out for freedom of speech up until October 7th. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in St. Petersburg and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.